Hello and welcome everyone to The Brief Podcast, where we try to bring you context, analysis, and perspectives on current events and international affairs. I'm your host, Jim Clancy. Be sure to follow us if you like what you find here on YouTube, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. We're told Israel aims for a final assault on the town of Rafah on the southern border with Egypt. Already, hundreds of thousands of Palestinian civilians are seeking shelter in the desert and the beaches, as instructed by Israeli military warnings. Once again, humanitarian aid remains stalled. Medical teams are without supplies or even enough water for the doctors and nurses. All right, there is still no plan for administering to millions of Palestinians when this is over. The long-threatened total defeat of Hamas, that appears questionable, as the group's forces appear to be reconstituting in areas already swept and devastated by the Israeli military. Our guest, Kenneth Roth, is the former executive director of Human Rights Watch for a decade, and he's now a visiting professor at Princeton University's School of Public and International Relations. Hello, Ken, and welcome to The Brief.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
How are you looking at the situation in Rafah today? And perhaps more importantly, what is the end game? It seems that we still don't have that established.
Well, it's pretty clear that there's not an end game that would be acceptable to anybody. In other words, you know, Netanyahu says that the end game is destroying Hamas, but at the same time, he refuses to countenance any Palestinian authority taking over in Gaza. He doesn't want a prototype state because he's opposed to a Palestinian state. And so what he does is he, you know, bombs parts of Gaza to smithereens, leaves chaos, the Israeli forces withdraw, and they're shocked that Hamas returns. And we've seen this already in northern Gaza, and we'll see it elsewhere as well, because when there is no governing authority, Hamas comes back. And which makes one wonder, like, well, what's the point of going after Hamas in Rafah if the same thing will happen there? And indeed, you know, both U.S. and Israeli intelligence now say that if the point was to go after Yahya Sinwar, the Hamas military leader who orchestrated the October 7th atrocities, they don't think he's in Rafah. They think he's in the tunnels of Khan Yunis, another area that Israel decimated without apparently getting the guy. So the only really way to make sense of this is, you know, either one, just utter revenge, you know, just destroy Gaza as opposed to destroying Rafah. But the other way to look at it is through the lens of the two far-right ministers in Netanyahu's government, whose votes in the Knesset hold the key to whether Netanyahu stays in power or not, and thus avoids his ongoing criminal trial or criminal charges for corruption. And that is Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, who both say exactly what they want. They want mass expulsion. They want to deal with Hamas by getting rid of the Palestinians, by another Nakba, by forcibly displacing 2 million Palestinians plus out of Gaza. And, you know, Netanyahu hasn't explicitly said that, but it's beginning to be the only way to make sense of why he goes into Rafah without any plan.
When we look at it, there's still a tremendous amount of support everywhere to apprehend and prosecute those people in Hamas who led the October 7th assault on Israelis, committing war crimes in the process, obviously, as they attacked civilians. We don't talk about that as much at this stage, but it's still vital overall to the defense of human rights.
Well, there's no question, Jim. I mean, the Hamas leadership, the military commanders who oversaw the large-scale killing and abduction of Israeli civilians on October 7th, they should be prosecuted for war crimes. Those were blatant war crimes. And there was much talk in the Israeli media a couple of weeks ago that they thought Netanyahu was about to be charged by the International Criminal Court. What got less attention is that there's no way that Karim Khan, the chief prosecutor, is going to charge Netanyahu without also charging the senior Hamas military commanders, as he should. They deserve to be prosecuted. So I anticipate both happening. I'm a bit surprised that after all this media attention, we haven't heard anything from Karim Khan. I mean, he obviously is going to hold his cards close to the vest until he formally charges. It's entirely possible that he has charged Netanyahu and has simply sealed the charges, you know, hoping to surprise him if he travels to Europe and capture him. I don't think at this stage that's a terribly wise strategy, because a public charge would have an important effect, you know, possibly deterring further atrocities, but also marginalizing the extremist people whom Khan would charge, probably not for bombing at this stage, I suspect at this stage, just for obstructing humanitarian aid to people who are starving. But, you know, that's bad enough. And we know from history that when these kinds of war crime charges are filed, they tend to marginalize extremist figures and actually make it more possible for competing sides to emerge from an armed conflict.
Throughout all of this, there have been charges of anti-Semitism. I know that Netanyahu said that it was an anti-Semitic hate crime if he were to be charged with war crimes over all of this. But one Israeli opinion writer wrote that, you know, this charge of anti-Semitism has been used like the Iron Dome to shield the Israeli government from charges, international charges, and really being held to account for the acts that it is committing.
Yeah, well, the person you're referring to was the former director of B'Tselem, the leading Israeli human rights group, who his argument was basically that the Holocaust had served as an Iron Dome for Israel, and that, you know, Israel just keeps referring back to the Holocaust, and that tends to get them away with whatever the latest thing is they're doing to Palestinians. And he says that, you know, that is now not working anymore. People have seen through that excuse, and they're assessing what Israel is doing. Now, the separate thing you note, though, is that both Netanyahu and many others are misusing the charge of anti-Semitism to try to silence criticism of Israeli war crimes in Gaza. And, you know, to call a potential war crime charge coming out of the International Criminal Court as anti-Semitic cheapens the very important concept of anti-Semitism. You know, there is a serious problem out there. It needs to be addressed. But when it so blatantly is used, the concept of anti-Semitism is so blatantly used, you know, not to fight hatred against Jews, but rather to fend off criticism of Israeli war crimes, that cheapens the concept. That makes it harder to defend against anti-Semitism. And it shows what's going on here. There are people who really are willing to sacrifice Jews around the world just in the name of protecting this far-right government in Israel. That is an utter misuse of the concept of anti-Semitism.
What has happened to Israel's image, in your view, during the 7 months of conflict, of carnage, really, that we've witnessed?
Well, I actually, you know, a couple days after October 7th, I wrote a piece in The Guardian. And I basically, you know, speaking to Netanyahu through the media, said, don't make the mistake that George Bush made after September 11th. You know, that just as the United States had the moral high ground, you know, the sympathy of the world after the terrible attacks of September 11th, 2001, so Israel had the moral high ground. They had the sympathy of the world after the horrible attacks of October 7th, 2023. I said, don't dissipate that by responding in a atrocity-laden way, the way George Bush did. Netanyahu obviously didn't listen. And he has responded with this, you know, virtual scorched earth response inside of Gaza, you know, decimating entire neighborhoods, killing now, you know, roughly 35,000 Palestinians, you know, half of them women and children, probably two-thirds of them civilians. So he ignored the importance of maintaining the moral high ground, which Israel had after October 7th. And now he is faced, I think, justifiably, with universal outrage. You know, even Joe Biden, who was, you know, one of the last holdouts, is utterly furious at Netanyahu, and, you know, has begun to match his strong words with the beginnings of deeds. You know, the U.S. has stopped sending these horrible, massive 2,000-pound bombs to Israel, which Israel had been using with such horrible effect to pulverize entire neighborhoods. These are utterly inappropriate bombs to be using in populated areas. And Biden says, we're not going to give you any more of these if you're going to go into Rafah with them. You know, so that was an important point of action to correspond with his strong words of disapproval. We need to see more of that, because it's quite clear that Netanyahu is not listening, that his so-called limited operation going into Rafah has now displaced just about 450,000 people, so say call it a third of the 1.4 million people who are sheltering in Rafah. You know, this is not a limited operation. This looks like a full-fledged invasion. And if he's, you know, basically just thumbing his nose at Joe Biden, even after the 2,000-pound bomb delivery was canceled, Joe Biden's got to ratchet up the pressure.
is he going to be willing to do that? I mean, we have watched harsh language hurled at Mr. Netanyahu and his compatriots in that hardline government to absolutely zero effect. And Joe Biden just doesn't seem to be able to bring himself to do anything about it in a forceful way until, as you said, you know, we're not delivering 2,000-pound bombs, just 1,000-pounders.
Well, look, there are additional arms that have been going forward. They should be stopped. And there are other things that Biden could do, too. He could allow a UN Security Council resolution to go forward condemning the war crimes in Gaza. He could make it clear that he endorses International Criminal Court action addressing the war crimes in Gaza. I mean, these are steps that would really step up the pressure. Biden has not yet been willing to take them. But, you know, even cutting off the 2,000-pound bombs was, you know, the first action to follow upon his strong rhetoric. And we need to see more of that if we hope to stop just an utter disaster in Rafah and potentially, you know, as I mentioned, the mass deportation of 1 million, 2 million Palestinians.
The American media has really been roiled over the protests that have been on campus. But, you know, as we look at that, the protesters are coming under fire for they shouldn't be there. They can't disrupt other people's lives with, I must say, very little focus on what the students are really trying to tell people, that they've seen enough.
Yeah, I mean, I have mixed feelings about the protests. I mean, on the one hand, I completely empathize with the students and their outrage over what Netanyahu and the Israeli government are doing in Gaza. And this is their way of expressing it. And they have clearly illustrated to Biden how important this is to a, you know, potentially a significant segment of his base, you know, people whom he's counting on to vote for him in November. And, you know, these are not people who are going to vote for Trump, but, you know, they could just not vote, which is effectively the same thing. And Biden, I think, has to start worrying about that. You know, I wish that the students would be more focused, though, on Biden directly. You know, this focus on disinvestment is, you know, something that, you know, is closer to home. It's their institution. They can ask, you know, their own university president to do it. But, you know, disinvestment is hardly something that, you know, the Israeli government is going to feel the heat about. And, you know, I think the students are thinking, oh, we're going to follow in the footsteps of what happened with South Africa. But in fact, what stopped South Africa was the, you know, the lack of purchases, the real commercial boycotts of South African industries. I think what would make a difference in the case of Israel is a much firmer response from the U.S. government. And the students are really in a position to make a difference there. But that hasn't been their primary audience. You know, their primary audience has been the stuff close at home, the disinvestment, which I just think is, you know, is fine, but it's a bit of a diversion.
Well, and they're not experienced at this. Mm-hmm. I mean, they looked at the past and they have imitated it to some measure, but they don't seem to be able to, as you said, to sort some of these issues out, what matters, what doesn't matter. But they all seem to be saying the same thing in terms of, we haven't been told the truth about Israel, about the state of human rights in Palestine. Are they right?
Well, it depends who you're referring to. I mean, in other words, you know, I mean, Human Rights Watch, you know, our colleague organizations have spoken the truth for years. I actually think if you look at the media, I mean, the New York Times doesn't use certain words. They're reluctant to use the word apartheid or genocide, but they've been describing factually pretty well what has been going on. Where the institution that doesn't state the conclusions that are obvious is the U.S. government. You know, Biden committed to a State Department report assessing whether Israel was committing war crimes in a way that would, you know, force the U.S. to stop sending weapons. And, you know, the State Department had this ridiculous cop-out where they said, well, yeah, it looks pretty bad, but we just don't know for sure because
not enough evidence.
They're not letting us investigate. You know, we don't have enough evidence. So our close partner, the military that we're sending $3.8 billion in military assistance to every year, we're just supplementing that with $16 billion. We're sending them arms, you know, it seems every week. They're not letting any investigators in. So we're going to give them the benefit of the doubt. And in any event, don't worry, because they're assuring us that they, of course, respect international humanitarian law. You know, that's outrageous, that kind of, you know, whitewashing. But that's what the State Department did. And that just shows the lengths to which the Biden administration is willing to go to continue arming a government that is committing systematic war crimes. Now, that's aiding and abetting war crimes. I mean, that itself is a war crime. Not that I think Biden's about to be prosecuted for it, but, you know, theoretically, he could be.
You know, we talk about, and it's certainly after October 7th, many in Israel felt there was an existential threat to the state of Israel. As I look at the crisis now, 7 months later, as this is just grinds on with terrible loss of life, and certainly, I mean, loss of all housing units in Gaza, or a majority of them, there's another really difficult decision Israelis are going to have to make, and that is, what country do they want? They can't. Do you think there's a realization that this occupation just can't go forward? They can't live in the region with an occupation and still be the Israel that they aspire to be?
You know, the problem is that certainly the Israeli government, and to, I think, a significant part of the Israeli people, are in denial about the real options. You know, here they've been, you know, occupying Palestinian territory since 1967. It's pretty much an endless occupation. They have what is many people call a one-state reality. You know, the endless expansion of the settlements and the outposts and the bypass roads in the West Bank has, you know, left, you know, 160-some separate enclaves, you know, nothing like a viable, contiguous Palestinian state. And that's by design. So with this one-state reality, what do they want? Do they want to give everybody equal rights within it? No. Do they want to just keep the apartheid going? Well, they pretend it's not apartheid, but effectively that is the policy. Netanyahu rules out the obvious solution, which is a Palestinian state, you know, somewhere close to the 67 borders. The other thing that is far-right ministers are mooting, of course, is mass expulsion, you know, solve the problem of Palestinians by getting rid of them. And, you know, at this point, Netanyahu seems to, you know, his usual strategy is kick the can down the road, which basically means more apartheid. The Israeli public seems okay with that. Now, you know, it could be that Netanyahu...
Well, he certainly reelected him numerous times,
yes,
and it's always been his policy.
Exactly. Now, you know, he, if there were another election today, he's vulnerable, but not because of the apartheid policy. He's vulnerable because he is, you know, had a horrible intelligence failure on October 7th, because there was actually a lot of signals that Hamas was about to do what it was going to do, what it did. And the Israeli government just downplayed them. They didn't take it seriously. They didn't think Hamas would do it. And at some point, there will be a political reckoning with Netanyahu, in which case he, you know, is likely to lose power. I think part of why he wants to keep fighting is he kind of hopes for some deus ex machina. You know, he can kill Yahya Sinwar. He can do something that, you know, redeems him and gets people to stop talking about his political intelligence failure on October 7th. But that's, you know, his only strategy. And it sadly is a strategy to keep the war going, because, you know, the political reckoning won't start until the war ends. And this is just, you know, a reason for Netanyahu to keep fighting and fighting and fighting. You know, who cares?
Well,
how
you have argued that now is the point that Israelis and the international community should really be trying to reach that elusive ceasefire and get a return of the hostages, as so many Israelis want to see. I mean, the plight of those hostages is very real in the minds. We see the demonstrations, hundreds of thousands of people coming out. This has been an Independence Day that was really marked by a sadness that I don't think I've seen in my lifetime.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's, well, two things are clear. One is that, you know, the only way to get the remaining hostages out alive is through a deal with Hamas. You know, that's been the history of this conflict. I think three have been liberated, you know, through military action. I think roughly the same number have been killed through military action. The 100 or so who were released was through a deal. And that's, you know, likely the only way that the remainder will come out as well. But Netanyahu doesn't want a deal. He, in essence, is willing to sacrifice the lives of the hostages in order to keep on fighting for this, you know, elusive win that might salvage him politically. And that's what's going on right now. So, you know, even though I think everybody, including the Israeli people, sees that a, you know, a deal is the only way to save the hostages, that ongoing fighting has, you know, no more chance of destroying Hamas than the fighting so far has destroyed Hamas, which it hasn't. There's a lot pushing for a deal, but pushing back is this guy who's in charge, Netanyahu, who's afraid of having the war end because then his political reckoning begins.
You know, the humanitarian situation right now for the Palestinians, they are fleeing once again. But I understand that the doctors, well, doctors and nurses don't even have water for themselves. I mean, everybody is having to move out of the most dangerous areas of Rafah and seek shelter someplace else. Humanitarian aid being blocked by sometimes Israeli activists, extremists, if you will, burning the humanitarian aid on its way to Gaza or being blocked down by the borders. So, I mean, what in your estimation, what is this humanitarian situation? And, you know, we've been hearing for months it was going to lead to starvation, but that hasn't been widely reported.
Well, I mean, I think at this stage, it's pretty accepted that famine has set in particularly northern Gaza. You know, that's what Samantha Power, the USAID administrator, said. That's what Sidi McCain, the World Food Program head, said. So that is accepted at this stage. Now, I should note that the obstruction of humanitarian aid is also the most likely charge that Karim Khan, the International Criminal Court prosecutor, will bring against Netanyahu and others. So this remains a big issue. Now, Joe Biden, a few weeks ago, after the World Central Kitchen workers, the seven workers were killed, you know, had a real down-to-earth conversation with Netanyahu, at which point Netanyahu promised to allow in more aid. And that's when, in addition to the two southern crossings at Rafah and Kerem Shalom, he opened up Erez crossing to a limited extent in the north and has allowed some food to come in through Ashdod, the Israeli port in the north. But that modest increase in aid from the north has been completely undermined in the last week by the closure of the two principal border crossings in the south, where at this point, nothing is coming through. You know, a bit of fuel, but basically no food, no medicine. And we're seeing, you know, reports that even there are only three hospitals in Rafah. One of them is basically had to close down because of the Israeli military operation. There are reports now that the doctors and the remainder, they themselves are beginning to suffer from, from having not enough water. You know, that there's, you know, the basic necessities of life, even the doctors don't have. So this is a horrible situation. And, you know, there is no justification for this in terms of just a proportionality analysis. I mean, the harm being done to the civilian population is enormous compared to whatever conceivable benefit Netanyahu claims to be gaining militarily. That's different from his political motives. But, you know, again, it highlights the need for intensified pressure on Netanyahu for this utter indifference to Palestinian civilian lives to stop.
You know, Mr. Netanyahu has a lot of goals, and one of them clearly is to destroy the UN's Palestinian agency, the UNRWA, and replace it with something else. But Joe Biden seems to be going with him hand in hand into the surf off Gaza with his scheme to bring in a floating barge or a floating dock. And everybody looks at me, what are you out of your mind? That's expensive. It doesn't work. It's complicated. And you have border crossings, land crossings that you could open and let food aid in. Why create this new one? Unless the goal is just to remove that word refugee from the lexicon of the Middle East.
Yeah. Well, Jim, we're talking about two different things here. I mean, one is you're absolutely right. It is absurd to be airdropping aid, which is dangerous. And it's just dangerous. It's just a smidgen of the aid that's required. It's hugely expensive and time-consuming to build a temporary port off of Gaza for these sea deliveries. None of this would be necessary if they just opened up the land crossings where, you know, aid at scale could come in. But rather than pressure Netanyahu to do that, they set up these second-best alternatives, you know, distant second-best. So there's an absurdness to that policy. But separately, even if the food gets to Gaza, the question is who distributes it? And the agency with by far the best capacity to do that, with 13,000 employees, which dwarfs everybody else, is UNRWA. But Netanyahu is seeing this conflict as an opportunity to try to kill UNRWA. You know, he cited the fact that you know, supposedly a dozen UNRWA employees took part in the October 7th attack. You know, the proof of that has been slow in coming, but, you know, let's accept that for truth for hypothetically. UNRWA did the right thing immediately. They fired the people who were still around. You know, there are open investigations. And nonetheless, Netanyahu pursued this vendetta to get a bunch of governments to stop funding UNRWA in the midst of this crisis, in the midst of, you know, spreading starvation and imminent looming famine. And what that is about is that, you know, Netanyahu has long hated UNRWA because he falsely believes that without UNRWA, Palestinian refugees would forget that they were Palestinian refugees. Because UNRWA is not simply a service delivery vehicle within Gaza. It also provides education and healthcare to Palestinian refugees in Lebanon, in Syria, in Jordan. And Netanyahu would like to forget about those Palestinian refugees and get them to stop demanding the right to return to their ancestral home. And I should know he keeps saying, oh, but this would destroy Israel as a Jewish state. Well, you know, partly that is Israel's problem because these refugees are only there because of the 1948 expulsion of 700,000 of their ancestors. But more to the point, Israel won't even let them come back to the West Bank or Gaza, to Palestine. You know, it blocks that as well. So, you know, this whole refugee problem, you know, may not have been fully settled and that many would like to go to their ancestral homes in Haifa or Tel Aviv or what have you. But, you know, a big halfway step, an important step would have been taken by just letting them go back to Palestine. And he won't even do that. And so for that reason, they're languishing often in camps, you know, often unintegrated in their local societies in these other Middle Eastern states. And killing UNRWA isn't going to get these people to forget who they are. It's not going to get them to stop recognizing themselves as Palestinian refugees who have this ongoing connection to Palestine.
Are you hopeful about the future at all? I mean, we're looking at this dragging on. The war could open another front with Lebanon and Hezbollah. That's a risk that's always out there. If someone wants to continue the fight in order to protect themselves, shield themselves against trials for corruption. But where do you find any hope in this ever, as it winds down? If there is not some kind of solution to that problem, that core problem of all of those refugees wanting their right to return, something I'm told that Israel agreed to on its founding.
Look, I mean, the only point of hope here is that there's a good chance that at some stage in the not too distant future, this far right government of Netanyahu is toppled and a more centrist government emerges that is willing to make some of the difficult decisions and difficult compromises required to allow some kind of two-state solution to emerge. That's not going to be easy because, as I mentioned, you know, Israeli government after Israeli government is doing everything they can to undermine the possibility of a two-state solution. You know, they build all the settlements. They, you know, in fact, you know, until October 7th, Netanyahu was encouraging Qatar to fund Hamas because he saw that so long as Hamas existed, there wouldn't be pressure on him to negotiate for a two-state solution. So there's an utterly cynical approach to this. But I think, you know, if Netanyahu, if the far right is sufficiently discredited, there's possibility of something decent coming out of tragedy. I don't pretend it's going to be easy, but that's the only, I think, note of hope that one can take from this.
It's still, it would appear, everything in the hands of the Israeli voters, the Israeli public. It is their country. It is their decision to make.
I mean, that's true. Israel is, you know, within the green line a democracy. But the rest of the world doesn't have to go along if the Israeli government, if the Israeli people keep making bad decisions. And, you know, the U.S. government so far has basically given Israel a green light, a blank check. Do whatever you want. We'll support you. And that's no longer tenable. That's what the campus protests represent. And these students, you know, reflect just a part of a much broader set of public opinions across the United States, including among many American Jews who have had it with this government and don't want the U.S. government supporting the war crimes, the apartheid strategy that Netanyahu is pursuing.
Kenneth Roth, I want to thank you very much for joining us here on The Brief.
Thanks for having me, Jim. My pleasure.
And thank you for joining us for another edition of The Brief podcast. We hope you enjoyed this discussion with Kenneth Roth. And we invite you to sample some of our other editions that are available to you on YouTube, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. Give us a like, a follow, or subscribe. Again, thanks. I'm your host, Jim Clancy, and you've been briefed.